Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
We're starting. Can I ask everyone to turn their phones off? Thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute tonight, and thanks to King and Wood Mallesons for providing this facility. As Paul Fletcher makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, I'll introduce him briefly because he's well known to all of you. He worked as a solicitor in Mallesons, went into business in various places, including Optus, a member for Bradfield since 2009, initially Parliamentary Secretary for Communications, in the coalition government, then Minister for Territories, Local Government and Major Projects, and now Minister for Urban Infrastructure. In that capacity, Mr. Fletcher will talk to the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic of how we fund Australia's roads. Minister, many thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard. It's great to be here once again at the Sydney Institute. To you and Anne, congratulations on all you do in providing this very important forum for an exchange of ideas. I do apologise for being slightly late. I was caught on a congested road. In my previous portfolio responsibilities for mobile black spots, I frequently found myself on mobile phones that were dropping out, and those on the other end of the phone would highlight that I needed to do something to fix that. And of course, people might say the same about congested roads. But I do want to talk about how we fund Australia's roads, and start with the observation that a few weeks ago I had the chance to ride in a Tesla Model S. These $125,000 electric vehicles are becoming a much more common sight in Sydney. Today, electric vehicles make up around 0.5% of our vehicle fleet, but over the next 20 years, on some projections, they could reach 30% of all vehicles. And for environmental and many other reasons, many Australians would say that was a good thing. But there is a serious complication in this story. A car is not much use without a road to drive on, and roads are extremely expensive to build, operate and maintain. Across Australia, we spend about $25 billion a year on our roads. That's over $1,400 per vehicle. And of that, the federal government provides the largest contribution, funded largely from fuel excise, the 39.6 cent a litre tax, which raises around $10.8 billion each year. If you drive a 12-year-old Holden Commodore, on a typical tank of fuel, you'll drive around 650 kilometres and you'll pay, therefore, around 4.5 cents a kilometre through fuel excise. If you drive a 2010 Renault, you get more kilometres for every litre of fuel you buy, and your effective charge per kilometre works out to around 3.5 cents a kilometre. And if you drive a hybrid petrol electric vehicle, such as a Toyota Prius, you use much less fuel, so you pay around 1.5 cents a kilometre. If you drive a Tesla Model S, how much do you pay towards the cost of our road system through fuel excise? Precisely nothing. Now, my point in explaining this is not to criticise Tesla drivers. They didn't invent our present system for funding roads. Indeed, many Tesla drivers, like many other Australians, are likely to be unaware of exactly how our road funding system currently works. And of course, because of the high upfront cost of a Tesla, their owners pay the luxury car tax and also high state stamp duty, so they certainly do contribute to the cost of our roads. But I cite the example of the Tesla to illustrate the theme of my remarks this evening, that there are some significant problems with our system for funding Australia's roads, and one of those is that as cars become more fuel efficient and as electric vehicles become more common, fuel excise revenue will come under increasing pressure. So tonight I want to firstly describe our present system for building, operating and maintaining roads in Australia and how we pay for that system. Next, I want to review what's been said about our present system and its problems in a whole series of reviews over recent years. And in the final section of my remarks, I want to talk about the Turnbull government's agenda in this area. So let me start with a description of our current system. In Australia, we have around 880,000 kilometres of road. Roughly two-thirds of that is dirt roads in country Australia. Interestingly, only about 250 kilometres, less than 1/30th of 1%, is toll roads. Our roads are built and maintained by two main groups of organisations. Each state and territory government has an agency responsible for this function. Department of Roads and Maritime Services in New South Wales, Vic Roads in Victoria, Transport and Main Roads in Queensland, and so on. But these agencies are only responsible for the main arterial roads. By distance, the bulk of Australia's roads, almost 650,000 kilometres, are owned and maintained by the 550 local councils around Australia. We do have a federal highway system, the Hume Highway, the Pacific Highway and the Bruce Highway, and others that form part of what's called the National Land Transport Network. And these roads receive priority for federal funding, but they are still owned, maintained and operated by state governments. For example, there's a historic transformation of the Pacific Highway underway, so that by 2020 it will be four-lane all the way to the Queensland border. And the Australian government has committed $5.6 billion towards this upgrade. But it is the New South Wales Department of Roads and Maritime Services which is designing the upgrades and awarding contracts to construction partners such as Leighton's and Fulton Hogan. Building and operating roads is a very expensive exercise. In 2014-15, New South Wales Roads and Maritime Services spent around $1.5 billion on maintenance, and its capital expenditure that year was around $2 billion, of which roughly half was on the Pacific Highway. Vic Roads spent $1.32 billion maintaining and operating roads, and CapEx was over $700 million. And what's more, the total national spending on our roads has been rising steadily over the past 20 years. Where then does that money come from? Well, that depends on how you look at it. The most basic answer is that it comes from the general taxation revenue of federal, state and local governments. By this I mean that each year New South Wales Roads and Maritime Services or the analogous agencies in other states are allocated a budget to spend on their tasks of building new roads and maintaining and operating existing roads. This budget is funded out of the state's tax revenues, both road-related and general, supplemented by grant funding from the Commonwealth Government and also by revenue streams from the small number of toll roads owned and operated by the state roads agencies. So, for example, New South Wales RMS in 2014-15 has total revenue, according to its annual report, of around $5.5 billion. Of that, $1.9 billion came from state taxes on motor vehicles, $1.4 billion from the general state budget, $1.5 billion in grants from the federal government, and around $800 million in revenue earned directly by RMS, for example, driver's licence. I want to highlight a key point here. The state government organisations which provide road services are fundamentally different in character to state government organisations which provide services such as water and sewerage and electricity. In other words, water and sewerage services are provided by government business enterprises. They charge their users for the provision of services and they generate revenue. Out of that revenue, they fund capital upgrades and also carry out operations and maintenance. And the same is true of the electricity networks, where they remain in government hands, and of course is even more true when they're in private hands. Roads, though, are different, because a state road agency does not have a revenue stream which comes directly from charges paid by users of the network. Instead, it has a budget appropriation each year, and of course that appropriation can vary materially from year to year, depending amongst other things on the vagaries of politics. I've pointed out that road agencies do not receive a revenue stream, but certainly road users pay very significant charges and generate a lot of revenue. The point is that this goes into the consolidated revenue of governments, and then a share of it gets allocated to the road agencies of state governments and to local councils. This next chart sets out the main components of the charges paid by road users. fuel excise, user charges paid by heavy vehicles, registration charges, stamp duty, road-related GST, and other vehicle-related charges. And I want to highlight an important point here. There is a separate system for imposing on heavy vehicles, those above 4.5 tonnes, specific charges for their use of the road. Now, a key reason that we treat heavy vehicles separately is that they do much more damage to the road than light vehicles. In fact, almost all of the maintenance costs are generated by the impact of semi-trailers, which can weigh up to 45.5 tonnes, and even larger vehicles such as B-doubles, which can weigh up to 68 tonnes. Now, the current heavy vehicle charging system, nevertheless, is fairly rudimentary, and that's generating increasing frustration from the heavy vehicle industry, principally because they cannot see much connection between the amounts they pay and the services they receive. For example, the Australian Trucking Association recently had this to say, quotes, "The system should raise about $2.9 billion per year. The National Transport Commission estimates that it will overcharge truck and bus users by $190 million in 2015-16. As an economic principle, user charges should reflect the cost of providing infrastructure, in this case roads. Giving businesses a transparent signal about the cost of infrastructure gives them an incentive to use it efficiently." End quote. Well, over the past few years, there's been a striking number of reviews and studies of our current road funding system. And a clear and common theme comes out of those studies: we have a problem. In 2010, the Henry Review examined our current tax system. It concluded that current road tax arrangements will not meet Australia's future transport challenges, that existing institutions have not led to the most efficient use and supply of roads, and that our current system, quotes, raises revenue but harms efficiency. For example, Henry argued that our current user charging system for heavy vehicles does not efficiently price the costs of road wear caused by heavy vehicles, and recommended that governments should accelerate the development of mass distance location pricing for heavy vehicles to ensure that heavy vehicles pay for their specific marginal road wear costs. In 2014, the Productivity Commission reported on its study into the funding and financing of public infrastructure. The Commission argued that current, quotes, current governance, taxation and institutional arrangements for the funding and provision of roads are presenting challenges for coherent long-term planning and investment in road infrastructure and are ultimately unsustainable. The Commission went on to say there is no direct link from road-related revenue to road-related expenditure. This makes it difficult to determine road users' preferences and willingness to pay for road infrastructure services. Last year, the Turnbull government received the report of the Harper Review into competition policy, which observed that, quotes, roads are the least reformed of all infrastructure sectors, with institutional arrangements around funding and provision remaining much the same as they were 20 years ago. More effective institutional arrangements are needed to promote efficient investment in and usage of roads and to put road transport on a similar footing with other infrastructure sectors. Close quotes. Infrastructure Australia commented on the same issue in the Australian Infrastructure Plan released earlier this year. It argued that the way we currently collect and distribute charges for using the road network is inefficient, unfair and unsustainable. Access and usage charges are opaque and blunt, bearing a very limited relationship to actual use of the road network. Once collected by governments, these charges are treated the same way as other taxation revenue, from which the government allocates funding to recurrent spending and specific priorities both within and outside of transport. And Infrastructure Australia highlighted what it saw as two consequences of these features. Firstly, that there are only limited links between use and charging, leaving the connection between demand and supply to little more than the informed guesses of policymakers. And secondly, that cyclical funding and inefficient allocation means that we do not invest enough in maintaining and renewing our road networks, resulting in what Infrastructure Australia called a hidden deficit of maintenance liabilities and declining service standards. Now, it's not just these government reviews which have argued that there are significant problems with the current system. In 2014, a number of motoring clubs joined with advocacy group Infrastructure Partnerships Australia to issue a paper entitled Road Pricing and Transport Infrastructure Funding Reform Pathways for Australia. And that paper described the complex flow of revenues back into the provision of roads, noting that these arrangements see the majority of taxes collected flowing through to the Commonwealth and state consolidated revenue, and therefore that the path for returning funds to road operations, maintenance and capital investment is complex and convoluted. The Australian Trucking Association, the year before, had commissioned a paper from PwC entitled A Future Strategy for Road Supply and Charging in Australia, which concluded that a more transparent and efficient model for investment in roads and charging for their use is overdue. And South Australian Premier Jay Weatherill told the National Press Club last year that it's getting harder for governments to meet the demands of road users from general taxation revenue, and roads remain a sector that relies heavily on taxpayers to fund new projects. He went on to say, quotes, "I therefore propose that we establish a national heavy vehicle road user charging system run by the Commonwealth, in which state-based registration and federal-based fuel excise charges are replaced by a charging system based on mass, distance and location." Well, if there's widespread agreement that our current system for funding roads faces some significant challenges, what then is the Turnbull government doing about it? Well, there's a concise summary of our agenda in the response the government gave late last year to the Harper Review into Australia's competition policy, where we said that we would accelerate work with states and territories on heavy vehicle road reform, and we would investigate the benefits, costs and potential next steps of options to introduce cost-reflective road pricing on all vehicles. And importantly, it's not just the Commonwealth which has agreed to pursue this reform path. So the Council of Australian Governments in December 2015 committed to develop a new competition reform agreement drawing on the Harper Competition Policy Review. I want to highlight here that we're talking about two separate strands of work at very different stages of development. We've committed to accelerate work on heavy vehicle road reform, on vehicles which weigh more than 4.5 tonnes. And to be clear, this represents around 550,000 vehicles of the 18 million vehicles presently on Australia's roads. When it comes to the arrangements to apply to the great majority of vehicles, our commitment is to investigate the benefits and potential next steps of a road pricing system and whether they would outweigh the costs. That's a very different thing to making a decision to proceed with such a system, and there are many issues we would need to understand much better before we would contemplate such a change, and I'll come back to that. But let me first give a little more detail on our planned reform approach in relation to heavy vehicles. The heavy vehicle work is being led by the Commonwealth and State and Territory Transport and Roads Ministers working collaboratively. Together we form what is known as the Transport and Infrastructure Council. And in January, the Council released two important sets of documents concerning Australia's key freight routes. These are roads like the Pacific Highway, the Bruce Highway, the Hume Highway, the Newell Highway. And as this map shows, these are roads that are used extensively by heavy vehicles. The first thing we released was national expenditure plans, which essentially set out the dollars planned to be spent on these roads until 2018-19. And secondly, we released asset registers. These set out a description of the condition of each road by 100 metre segment. This is all part of developing what is known in an unappetising piece of economic jargon as a, quotes, forward-looking cost base. Now, there is, as I've argued, no linkage at the moment between what road users pay today and what they get for the money. And that's true of light vehicles, but it's also true of heavy vehicles, notwithstanding the heavy vehicle user system that I talked about a bit earlier. The problem is the charges today are based on the past spending decisions of government. The objective is to move to an approach where heavy vehicle charges are based on the life cycle costs of delivering road services to the heavy vehicle industry. The price that heavy vehicles pay should be derived by working out how much the road agencies need to spend looking forward to keep the roads to an agreed service standard. But calculating a true forward-looking cost base is a complex job, and we need much better data than we've previously gathered, hence the work now underway. Another key question in heavy vehicle road reform is establishing an independent price regulator, which would have the power to calculate the user charge for heavy vehicles in accordance with an agreed formula, drawing, amongst other things, on that forward-looking cost base I talked about earlier. And this would be the same job that the ACCC, for example, does today in markets like telecommunications and energy. Under current arrangements, that decision still sits with ministers, and furthermore, as I've argued, it occurs based on past costs with no reference to future investments. Over the past few months of this year, I've held roundtable discussions in several cities with stakeholders in the heavy vehicle industry, exploring some of these issues, and this has given me useful feedback about what the industry wants to see and some of their concerns. Let me now come back to the issue of light vehicles. What we do know, as has been found by the many reports and studies I cited earlier in this speech, is that we have a problem with our current road funding system. It's complicated and far from transparent. It's inequitable. If fuel excise revenues decline, as looks likely, it may become unsustainable. And we're not making investment and maintenance decisions which best respond to demand. What we do not yet know is whether a cost-reflective road pricing system would do a better job. There's a lot of work to do on understanding the impacts that road pricing would have on all users of the road system and the broader economy. And before taking a decision in this area, we'd need to be satisfied that the benefits from a broader use of road pricing would exceed the costs. We'd also need to be satisfied that the outcome would be a fairer system, reduced congestion, and better roads. We also need to make the case to the community, where, frankly, there is understandable scepticism. Let me give you an example. Earlier this year, I did a radio interview on Sydney radio station 2GB, where I talked about the way that we fund roads today. Following the interview, the host invited listeners to call in with their thoughts, and caller after caller expressed alarm at the notion of paying a per kilometre charge, using terms such as cash grab and new tax. Now, clearly, any new system would need to be built on the principle that the total amount being collected was not increasing. That is, if road costs were recovered through user charges, then there were offsetting reductions in fuel excise and state taxes. Let me repeat this. Under a new system, we would need to proceed on the principle that the total amount being collected was not increasing. And that's precisely what the Harper Review recommended. Any introduction of direct road pricing should be accompanied by reductions of indirect taxes and charges on road users. Part of the issue here is that most Australians have very little awareness of how they pay for roads today. According to research from the Australian Automobile Association, nearly one third of Australians do not know that the fuel price they pay at the pump includes a fuel excise charge of nearly 40 cents a litre. And another 42% know about fuel excise but do not know what the rate is. In the 2014 paper from Infrastructure Partnerships Australia and the Motoring Clubs, which I cited earlier, there's some interesting analysis of what Australians are paying today to use roads. Looking at three different scenarios, people living in different locations, driving different distances and using different cars, Deloitte's, which prepared the paper on behalf of the clubs, found that these typical Australians were paying between $15 and $50 a week in road use charges. In other words, up to $2,600 a year as the charges they presently pay to use the roads. Now, the Turnbull government is certainly fully aware of the sensitivities around this topic and that there are currently more questions than answers. That is why, when the Prime Minister and I released the Infrastructure Australia 15-year plan in February, we said that if there were to be a decision to go down the road pricing path for light vehicles, it would be a 10 to 15-year journey. But we should be clear about one thing. This is not a debate about whether Australians should face a charge to drive on the roads, because they already do. It's a debate about whether we could have a charging system which is clearer and more transparent than the one we have today, and whether such a system would make Australians better off. In this term of government, when it comes to light vehicles, our focus will be on a program of work to better understand how a system might operate and what its impact would be. We're particularly interested in what economists call the distributional consequences. What are the impacts on country people, for example, on outer suburban residents, people who drive long distances or short distances? How much do people in these different categories pay today? That's a crucial question. We need to understand that much better. And how much would they pay under a new system, which of course would likely involve considering different possible system designs and modelling their cost impacts. But there's much else we'd need to think about. What would the transition process to a new system be? What would be the respective roles for the federal and state and territory governments? Clearly, any change in this area could only occur if there were agreement between the Commonwealth and state and territory governments. There was a preliminary discussion at last week's meeting of the federal and state and territory transport ministers. In our communique following the meeting, we said that we noted the growing momentum for road charging and investment reform, including the Council of Australian Governments' December 2015 directive that the Transport and Infrastructure Council accelerate heavy vehicle reform and investigate the benefits and costs of introducing user charging for all vehicles. The communique noted that our immediate priority was further development of the heavy vehicle user system, but we also intended to progress next steps, including further, more detailed consideration of costs and benefits of reform. One way, of course, to get a better understanding of how a different system of road charging could work would be through conducting user trials. Presently, the South Australian Government is conducting a trial of the impact of a more direct heavy vehicle user charge on two case study routes. And the results of this trial will be very helpful as we progress the heavy vehicle charging reforms I spoke of earlier. But I expect that we may look for other trial opportunities. Well, let me conclude by repeating the observation I've made at a couple of points. The way that we fund Australia's roads is not well understood at all by most Australians. But when you do turn your mind to this issue, as I've been doing over the past few months since being handed ministerial responsibility for it, you soon conclude that it has considerable economic and social importance. Economic, because of the amount of money that we spend on roads and because of the importance of road transport as an input into such a large proportion of activity in our economy. And social, because using our roads to get from one place to another is of fundamental importance to all of us and to the operation of our modern Australian society. I've argued today that there are problems in the way that we fund our roads and significant opportunities from making some reforms in this area. The immediate priority is the way that we charge heavy vehicle users, where we have decided to make some changes to the current system. Of course, there's a lot of work ahead of us in developing the detailed changes required and in consulting with stakeholders. When it comes to the system for light vehicles, the government's thinking is at a much more preliminary stage. We know there are problems with the current road funding system. Whether a different system could work better is something we think would be worth investigating. There's plenty of work ahead before we can reach any conclusions from such an investigation. But one thing is clear, our current road funding system has some significant problems, and doing nothing about those problems is unlikely to be an effective strategy for addressing them. Thank you.
Many thanks, Paul. But just so I also should say again, thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for this facility today, which is a great facility here. So we come to question and discussion. We've got around to the top of the hour with a lot of people here, so can I ask you to keep your comments or your questions brief? And there's a microphone here. You started off by talking about funding, and you mentioned, of course, that most of the funding comes from Commonwealth funds and to the states and local government. But if I can just take you back a bit, to what extent the Commonwealth controls its own money. I'm not an expert on this, but as I recall, the coalition government, at the request of the Victorian coalition government, provided money for the East-West Link to overcome the enormous congestion down in Melbourne. The Andrews government came in, dropped the project, but kept the money. I mean, how does that work?
That is a good description of exactly what happened with the East-West Link. And it's also a good example of the way that the process for funding most major road projects occurs. It typically involves fairly considerable engagement between the federal government and the relevant state government. The majority of major road projects around the country do require Commonwealth funding to get off the ground. So WestConnex here in Sydney, with a $16 billion plus overall capital cost, has $1.5 billion of Commonwealth grant money in it, $2 billion of Commonwealth concessional loan. As you instanced, the Commonwealth offered significant funding to the Victorian government to build East-West Link. We committed to $3 billion, of which $1.5 billion was provided in cash to the Victorian government. There are projects all around the country at the moment. Perth Freight Link is backed by a commitment of close to $1 billion from the Commonwealth. The Northern Connector in Adelaide, Gateway Upgrade North in Brisbane, Toowoomba Second Range Crossing. In fact, the coalition, the federal coalition government, is spending about $50 billion between 2013-14 and 2019-20 on big infrastructure projects. I mentioned the $5.6 billion going into Pacific Highway between now and 2020. There's a commitment of over $7 billion extending beyond the Ford estimates in relation to the Bruce Highway. Typically, that is a feature, I guess, of one of the things that I instanced in the slides here, which is the somewhat lumpy nature of the revenue streams that the state road agencies have. And amongst the things that's been pointed out in the various reports that I cited is that we politicians, as a class, tend to get more enthusiastic about announcing new projects than maintenance on existing roads. And that's one of the factors that's relevant here.
Right, so question here.
Thanks, Minister. I don't think you mentioned another potential source of revenue, which I think Scott Charlton mentioned when he spoke recently, and that is for the urban setting congestion pricing, which has, I suppose, a double benefit of avoiding the need to build new tollways if you can reduce traffic flow.
Look, the point I'd make there is that congestion pricing is not something that the Commonwealth sees as a priority area for our involvement. We're thinking more about the overall nature of the system, where the money comes from at the moment, and the sustainability of it. If you think about where there's likely to be interest from policymakers, it's much more likely to be at a specific, an individual city level. And so where our interest in the road pricing debate or the road funding debate is about, I think, the overall effectiveness of the system and the sustainability of the system. And that's, I think, where you'll see the Commonwealth directing its energy.
There's a question here, then we go to Robin. Yep.
Minister, thank you. My observation of the public attitude towards roads over many years has been that people don't mind paying for roads if they see the payments that they made hypothecated to roads, e.g. the Bicentennial Roads Program, 6 cents a litre, etc. Why is hypothecation not a possibility compared to the other utilities?
The hypothecation, you know, the jargon word for tax revenues being dedicated to a particular expenditure, so in this case it would be revenues from taxes levied on road users being dedicated to road expenditure is certainly something that's been suggested in a number of these reports that I cited. So, and it, I think it can be seen as a specific instance of the general problem, which is that you've got road users paying substantial amounts on one side, but then the revenues that the people building, operating and maintaining roads, state road agencies, councils, are not reflective of what's being paid. So, look, I think it's one of the class of solutions that are being proposed by some, and what I'm obviously seeking to do in my remarks this evening is to direct some attention, first of all, to some of the features of the current system which suggest that we need to have a look at it.
Robin.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm part of the medical world, which sees the catastrophes in terms of road traffic accidents. Mm. One way of addressing that issue is to get as much as is reasonably possible off roads, particularly country roads, and onto that wonderful alternative form of transport, namely rail, which I suspect you're also responsible, which you haven't mentioned this evening. But there are three great advantages. One, notwithstanding Granville events, much lower rate of fatal accidents. Two, more efficient, you can work on trains. Three, you're not subject, generally speaking, to the kind of congestion. If you increase the costs for heavy vehicles on the road, might it not have the happy side effect of forcing some of that transport or some of that heavy transport onto rail?
Look, I think there's a number of important points here. The first is you're absolutely right. We need to think about the overall transport system and rail, road and other modes of transport as well. The second thing is that there certainly can be a congestion problem on rail. If you look at, for example, the traffic loads on the main Western Line in Sydney is one good example. And so, yes, rail certainly has some very significant efficiencies, there's no doubt about it, but at the same time, rail and road, all of these transport systems are facing strong growing demand as a consequence of population growth, increased economic activity and all these other drivers. I think the third point I'd make, though, is one of the challenges is what's the policy objective that you want to achieve as you think about the charges that are faced by users of the road. I reiterate the point I made a couple of times that people today pay significant charges to use the roads, but the structure, I mean, some economists have described it as a de facto two-part tariff in the economic jargon, but it hasn't really been designed that way. It's just sort of sprung up that way. And so, you know, one of the questions, I think, is what are the policy objectives you're trying to achieve, and then what should the charging system be to achieve those? You've made a point about, an important point about, well, one of our policy objectives ought to be safety, and that is makes obvious good sense.
Just a question here.
I was going to raise one other related issue, and that is where does coordination of tolls and congestion charging fit into your model?
We have a system where you have a relatively small proportion of roads around Australia which have tolls. I think the numbers I quoted, about 300 kilometres in a total of 800,000 plus kilometres around Australia. And those have sprung up in the main only in the last 25 years. That being said, the commentary from most of the reports that I've pointed to and the issue that I guess is exercising the Turnbull government as we think about these issues is the overall system. And I think that the question to ask is, what's our current, what are the current mechanisms for funding the system? Could those be optimised? Clearly, you would need to think about the existing toll roads in any such process. My feeling is there's a lot of other things you need to worry about first before you get to that issue.
I'm sorry.
Given the modern improvements in vehicle technology...
Just speak up.
Given the modern improvements in vehicle technology and assuming well-built roads in places like the New Highway, with the idea of faster, higher highway speeds be a possibility to encourage heavy vehicle industry to pay more for charges as they improve their efficiencies?
You've touched on a couple of very good points there. The first is productivity benefits for the heavy vehicle industry, such as, for example, the increasing penetration of B-doubles, which carry more tonnes of freight per prime mover than a semi-trailer does. That has productivity benefits. You've also talked about likely increases in automation of vehicles, which is a separate but related and highly relevant topic. There are a range of forecasts as to how quickly fully automated vehicles will arrive. Certainly there's a lot of heavy vehicle manufacturers looking at automated vehicles and this notion of so-called platooning. That's to say you have semi-trailers travelling just a few centimetres apart using communications technology to stay aligned. The head of Google X, which is the part of Google which deals with so-called moonshot projects, including the driverless car, was in Australia last year, and speaking to a group of parliamentarians, he made the point that if you look at a picture of cars on a freeway, vehicles on a freeway today from above, only 10 to 15% of the road surface is being used. The rest of it, when cars are travelling at the speed limit or close to, the rest of it is unused, and that really reflects human reaction time and the time needed to be able to, the distance needed to be able to brake if the car in front of you, the vehicle in front of you, brakes abruptly. One of the major research directions is this so-called idea of platooning, where you have vehicles travelling very closely together, all coordinated, also taking advantage of the peloton effect to reduce aerodynamic resistance. So there's a range of reasons why people say this is desirable. Now, there's a clear linkage between some of these technological developments in the future of vehicles and, again, the question of how we fund our road system. Because in a world where the majority of vehicles are electric, clearly our current system will no longer be fit for purpose in terms of raising the sort of money we need to sustain the system. At the same time, some people at least have a vision of a world of driverless vehicles where just about every vehicle on the road is like Uber without a driver. In other words, we become used to just summoning a vehicle when we want it, probably ordering it on our smartphone, it arrives, takes us to where we need to go, then goes somewhere else, never needs to park, immediately taking a lot of congestion off the roads, because the figures as to the percentage of vehicles on the roads that are circling looking for somewhere to park is surprisingly high in urban areas, 20 to 30%, I think. Driverless vehicles will be much less likely to crash. Crashes are bad for a whole host of reasons, but one is that they are drivers of congestion. So on some forecasts of the future of driverless vehicles, we'll stop owning vehicles, we'll regard them as a service, and indeed in that world, the notion of the commercial owner of the fleet of such vehicles being charged a service fee by the road owner would seem perfectly straightforward and absolutely normal. Long-winded answer to the question. I suppose I'll conclude by saying you are right that these issues are related, and as governments look at the future of road transport, we need to think about different scenarios, and there are strongly differing views, diverse views about how quickly there will be take-up of automated vehicles. There does seem to be a very wide consensus that we're going to see more and more automation of vehicles, and the issue in dispute is how quickly that will penetrate.
Dan?
Sure. Most people think about road funding relating to the road itself, but you started to touch on where I'm going now, and that's... what emphasis is being placed on infrastructure for to support vehicle connectivity and telematics? Because there's a lot of stuff, even just a semi-automation and safety features that would be available, that could be available in vehicles now that isn't without the supporting infrastructure. And if people had the benefit of that infrastructure to make their trip a whole lot smarter and decrease the benefits of decreased congestion and so on, as more people can get these vehicles, they might be more better, have a better outlook on changes to road funding if they're getting a more direct benefit from the infrastructure that it is funding.
That is a very good point, and particularly the way you've touched on the potential of automated vehicles to reduce congestion. One of the other scenarios that is posited is that in the future, you might order a taxi or a taxi-like vehicle, which is automated, which is connected into the network, is supported by software, which is continually optimising the route it's going to take. So you might order the taxi to go from your home to the shopping centre, 5 kilometres away. It will pick up other requests from customers wanting to travel to the shopping centre, will plot out the optimal route, and by the time you get to the shopping centre, there'll be 4 people in the vehicle, and yet it'll have been optimised so there's minimal disruption to each of the existing passengers. That could well mean that one vehicle does the work that today is being done by 3 or 4 vehicles. So, again, these issues are integrated or related. And you also ask the point, well, what about the infrastructure to support automated vehicles? And that is tricky to answer from the point of view of governments, because it's not entirely clear which system or systems will end up dominating. And different manufacturers are looking at different models. Some approaches are for the vehicle to be almost completely autonomous. It's got sensors, but it's got onboard computers, and those computers make all the key decisions. Other models see the vehicle as part of a system, networked, decisions are made at a network-wide level, and reliant on external indicators or structures to inform decisions. I think about it this way. I had the chance to ride in a Google driverless car in Mountain View in California in January, driving around a leafy, pleasant suburb, which looked very much like parts of my electorate, I might say. And, it worked pretty well as far as I could tell. Certainly the Google employee who was sitting in the front seat didn't put her hands on the steering wheel, and as far as I could tell, didn't put her feet on the pedals. What I'm not clear of is whether that would work on those two-thirds of Australia's roads that are dirt roads in the bush. And I strongly suspect the answer at this stage is no. I didn't get a very direct answer when I asked the question. But it comes to this question, who's going to have to pay for the infrastructure that automated vehicles may need? And it's... At the moment, I think what governments need to do is be making decisions that recognise that there are different ways this might develop. What does seem to be reasonably clear is there will be continuing demand for road capacity, what the features of a road might be in 30 or 40 years... We can't say with precision. Will traffic, in a world where all vehicles are automated, will there still be traffic lights? Most of the experts say no, because the vehicles will be part of a network, will communicate, and will make those, will safely intermesh without crashing. Now, if that turns out to be true, then that could mean a lot of money saved on so-called grade separations, which are things that a lot of money goes into at the moment, namely taking an intersection and putting one road over the top of another. A typical intersection, just thinking of one that's present in the subject of discussion between the federal government and the state government that should go unnamed, it's about $200 million. Now, if you had to do less of those, you'd save a lot of money, but we are certainly not at a point where we could say with confidence, let's stop doing grade separations because technology is going to solve the problem. Again, sorry, long answer, but it's a both fascinating and involved topic.
Now we've got time for three more comments, so we've all got to be brief. So it's one... Too late. Two, three.
Thank you for your talk. Could you give us your insights into, say, if we had looked at an example of airlines, rail, and highways between Sydney and Melbourne, and what impact a very fast train would have on that interactions?
Okay. Very fast train.
The principal issue with the very fast train is the economics of it. If it should fall, if a government were to build it, the most recent estimate was the work done when Anthony Albanese was the minister. He commissioned a study which said it would cost $114 billion to build a high-speed train from Melbourne to Brisbane. A lot of people think that's an optimistically low number. That project would involve building about the same length of track as Spain, one of the world leaders in high-speed rail, has developed over 30-odd years. Certainly, if there were private sector players who could build such a rail system at no cost to the taxpayer, the government would be very interested. We've yet to receive such a proposal, but if there is one, we'd be very interested.
Hi Paul, my name is Chris Turnbull, Design Roads. I just wanted to add to the autonomous vehicle. There's been a lot of discussion about the autonomous vehicles and the efficiencies for traffic from them. I've also seen some research suggesting that once you take out the labour costs of driving vehicles and you've got electric vehicles, and the cost of shared fleets can actually reduce the cost down to one-tenth of the cost of a taxi at the moment. So something I'm not sure is being really accounted for at the moment is the that incentive for people to then use roads once you have very easy door-to-door transport by shared fleets of autonomous robot vehicles. So that we've got to be cautious about the early conclusion to traffic efficiencies, although there will be efficiencies.
I think that's absolutely right. There is so much uncertainty here, and you see widely divergent forecasts as to whether more road capacity or less road capacity will be required. A cautious and sceptical government would not leap to the assumption that we'll need a lot less road capacity. I think we'd need to be persuaded of that.
Final?
I'm an older generation and I'm a female, and all these blokes have been talking about these wonderful tech-headed new developments. But as I looked at your map and I looked at the vast area that we have to pay for roads, and remembering Tim Fisher's favourite wish to get rid of all the black spots, Australia is at a great disadvantage with a small population and a huge continent. Are there any new ideas of how we're going to fund those roads that are outside Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, where people, there are not a lot of people to do user pays? Have you come up with any ideas?
Look,
is a problem.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely clear that whatever system you have, you must fund the provision of roads in uneconomic areas, where I think of the analogy from telecoms, where I've spent a lot of time working in telco policy. Of course, you have a universal service obligation under which the profits of running the network in the city, a portion of those gets deployed to funding the provision of the network in the bush. And I can't see any scenario where you wouldn't have a significant community service obligation type arrangement, where you wouldn't have a continued funding stream for roads all across the country.
Minister, thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.